we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
I'm Ben.
And this is our 101st episode where we're going to be starting off the 100s with Doctor Who. The return of Doctor Who for series 7.5 was this past weekend, and we are going to be looking at The Bells of St. John. I'm going to start off with a brief summary of the episode. The summary is as follows. The story begins with a warning. Don't click. People are dying after they click on strange alien Wi-Fi hotspots. But they're not really dead. Not yet, anyway. Their minds get uploaded into the cloud. Lost. Crying out for help. Meanwhile, the doctor is in 13th century Cumbria, living in monkish seclusion, contemplating how he'll find the mysterious twice-dead Clara Oswin Oswald. He is disturbed from his seclusion by the ringing of the TARDIS phone, the titular Bells of St. John. At the other end of the phone, modern-day Clara Oswald is having trouble with her internet and was given this phone number by a woman down at the shops who said it was the best helpline in the universe. The doctor is mystified until he realizes it's Clara, and he's off to modern-day London to find her. His first impression isn't his best, and while trying to convince Clara that he knows her and he needs to talk to her, she is uploaded by the Spoonheads, mysterious, swivel-headed robots. The doctor won't stand for this, and he hacks her back into her body. But Clara isn't quite the same, as she's had supercomputer hacker skills integrated into her in the process. These events set off a cat-and-mouse game between the doctor, the villainous Ms. Kislet, and her mysterious client. First, she demonstrates her power by activating humans all over London, causing a jet to hurtle towards the doctor and Clara like a guided missile. The doctor saves the jet by materializing aboard the plane and preventing the clash. Using Clara's infected laptop, the doctor attempts to locate the villains, but it is Clara's new hacking skills that allow her to track down the baddies. Meanwhile, the baddies track down the doctor, and while demonstrating to him how much power they have, they distract him enough to send a spoonhead that looks like him to permanently upload Clara. Their base is in the recently opened Shard, London's tallest building. Armed with an anti-gravity motorcycle, the doctor breaks into their headquarters where, with the help of the spoonheads themselves, the doctor forces the release of all the trapped people. Those with bodies still alive, like Clara, return to them. The others die and are released from their perpetual imprisonment. Unit arrives to clean up the mess, and Miss Kislet's client reveals itself to be the Great Intelligence, which orders the operation to be reduced, wiping out all the memories of the employee's time in the thrall of the Great Intelligence. The doctor asks Clara to join him in the TARDIS, but she declines, asking him to return tomorrow and ask again. Yeah, that's it.
In a nutshell.
In a nutshell, yes. That was it. So, what's your initial reaction to this story?
Kind of mixed. I mean, on the whole, I enjoyed it. But I think the reason I enjoyed it is because I like Jenna Louise Coleman so much. I find her as Clara to be, she offers a lot of comic relief, so to speak, but not in a zany sort of way. It allows for a lot of comic interplay between her and the doctor. So there's a really great chemistry there. But there were things that kind of had me a bit concerned. There was, without going too far, we get the reveal as to how she gets her middle name, Oswin, little things like that. And it just kind of, it makes me have this knee-jerk reaction that sort of reminds me of some of Russell T. Davies' worst episodes, mixed in with the whole River Song, meeting a woman out of time kind of thing.
Hasn't Clara got the most enormous pair of eyes you've ever seen?
She is so cute.
She is. She is terribly cute,
she's
I have to say.
She's terribly cute, and she's a mighty good actress. She speaks at 3 billion words a minute and is just spunky. So she has great interplay with the Doctor. I'm not sure who speaks faster, her or Matt Smith. So, of course, that means, you know, and I'm afraid that one of these days they're going to finish an episode and realize that between the two of them, they spoke the dialogue so fast that they still have 10 minutes of footage left to go.
Well, the sound gets a little out of sync sometimes on those when you're watching over the internet, so it could work out okay, actually.
Maybe. Like I said, it was sort of enjoyable. There were things that had me a little concerned, but they turned out okay. And then there were other things that had me just kind of think, oh, gee, I'm just afraid that the buildup is not going to be worth the payoff.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to say I did enjoy the episode. However, like you, I have some reservations about it, and I say on repeated viewings, my reservations go up each time, probably because I see more things that just didn't make sense or bother me about Moffat-like stories. The first is, and I hated this with Let's Kill Hitler, and I hate it with this one. The Bells of St. John. Is not Mr. Moffat smart enough, clever enough, to come up with a title that when you get to the end of the episode, you go, oh, I get what the episode was about. That fits totally perfectly, but doesn't give away anything about the plot. But instead, we get another complete red herring of a title. The Bells of St. John.
Misdirection.
Yeah, complete misdirection, like Let's Kill Hitler. It really had nothing at all to do with the story.
I found the Let's Kill Hitler title far more offensive in its misdirection than this one. But yeah. It's still kind of – that was the first thing that came to my mind. I thought, oh, man, Moffat, you're playing that game again.
Not every story has to be bleeding obvious as to what the title is, like Return of the Great Intelligence. Okay, I can see why you wouldn't want to use that one. But you know something? Terror of the Spoonheads would not have told us anything at all about this story or given anything away, because first off, no one would ever think they were spoonheads if they hadn't been told that. Even after I'd heard the name, I still couldn't figure it out for a while.
No, I didn't either until I actually saw it, and then I thought, oh.
No, I didn't see it when I turned around. I didn't get the spoon illusion. I thought, is it because they're eating the brains out of the person? Is that it? No, because the parabolic back of the head doesn't look like any spoon I ever owned, so it just did not get that. It was probably the third time I saw one turn around. I was like, oh,
I got
oh, how lame.
I got it on the first viewing, but I agree with you that Terror of the Spoonheads would have been a far better title and not give anything away.
Worldwide Web of Fear would have been the perfect title.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that would have been relevant to the overall story.
Would it have given it away, though? Web of Fear? Worldwide Web of Fear? Would that have given away? I didn't come up with that name, by the way. Somebody on the internet did.
Right.
But, I mean, would that have given it away? I don't think it would have, except the fact that we follow the snowman that had the great intelligence in it. And we know he wasn't really defeated in the end of that. So, I would have given away. But had they not done the snowman, I think you could have done Worldwide Web of Fear and nobody would have gotten it till the last scene and then gone, oh, what a great name.
Well, yeah, well, I think they would have gotten something on the initial titles, like, okay, well, something to do with the World Wide Web, obviously. But then, the payoff with the Great Intelligence, yeah, I think especially long-time Who fans would then get the deeper meaning of the joke.
I'm thinking that we should have a contest or something where we ask our listeners to come up with classic episodes of Doctor Who and rename them a la the Moffat. Like, for example, let's go with, say, The Leisure Hive. We could rename that The Sands of Brighton Beach. So think of classic episodes of Doctor Who. Come up with completely pointless names that could be used in such a ridiculous way.
I wouldn't even use Sands of Brighton Beach. I would.
Okay, The Rocks of Brighton Beach.
No, I would have said something.
Do they know what a beach is? Come on. Beaches do not look like that. Beaches have sand.
Yes, they do know. I would have gone with something like dog goes swimming.
Ooh, you're giving away a major plot point there. Death of Canine. Well, Death of Canine.
The Bells of St. John was something of a giveaway. I mean, once you realize what the Bells of St. John were, and they go, oh, man, really?
Actually, I had figured that one out, but incorrectly, but I had figured out it was the cloister bell. But it was obviously the TARDIS. I mean, St. John had to be the TARDIS, the logo on the TARDIS. But, okay, so it's the phone, which I don't like when the phone works anyway. Only seems to work in Moffat episodes, doesn't it?
Well, but even the Doctor said that wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah. Well, it was in The Empty Child as well. The phone rang. That's the only times I think the phone and the outside ever rang on the TARDIS.
Vaguely remember that.
Let's talk about Clara. Let's talk about her before we thrash bits about the plot. You talked about her a little bit. She's cute. She's perky. She's upgraded now with supercomputer hacking skills. So here's my question.
That bugged me to no end.
Here's my question. Is she influencing the other Claras, the dead ones, and any others that may exist in time and space, or are they influencing her? In other words, did she come up with Oswin because of Oswin? Did she become a nanny because of the nanny, or vice versa? Are you see what I'm saying? Which way is this working?
I don't know. Well, one thing, it's hard to say because we don't know her nature. We really don't know what she is.
And we never will because we've never seen her now without having been put through the spoonhead, too.
Well, I've got a little bit of a cheat here. I heard an interview with Jenna Louise Coleman just yesterday, and she did say that all the questions regarding her will be answered by the end of this season.
So here's the other thing I don't like about Clara. Not Clara per se, but so we have this mysterious woman. River Song, really? Maybe? I don't know. Gives her the phone number.
We know that River comes back this season,
right.
So it's a good bet that
it's her. A good bet. But what it basically means is once again, we've been presented with a story that's a fait accompli. It's already done. It's already told. And the Doctor is just filling in the pieces along the way.
All out of sequence.
Yeah. And whereas that's sort of clever once, maybe even twice, three times, four times? How many freaking times do we have to go through this? You've seen the answer first. I'm going to tell you. I mean, I don't even particularly like it unless it's handled really, really well. In one of those movies where you see the end first and then they go back and kind of fill it in. Those can be done well, but most of the time I don't like it. And I'm kind of sick of this. It's repetitive and I'm tired of this predestiny.
And they gave it they really gave it away with Clara having received her hacking skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, now we know how she was able to defeat the Dalek net in Asylum of the Daleks.
Which makes you wonder how the great intelligence in the 20th century Earth, having been born in the Victorian age, produced computer skills in just 100 years or so, 140 years, that are so good that when they upload them into Clara, they can defeat the Daleks, who have had millennia of brilliance and computer skills.
I mean, the only
Not
thing,
convinced.
The only thing, the only new wrinkle in all of this is that Clara is the twice-dead girl. That's
yeah.
The only new dimension to all of this.
And is it her, or is it has she been Jaggeroth'd? Has she been? Are they? Who knows what they are?
Well, you know this. What this raises a question, and that is the end of the Christmas episode.
Mm-hmm.
We see what looks like present day Clara standing in that same cemetery where her Victorian self got buried,
mm-hmm.
standing right over that gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
She's looking at the headstone. She sees her name. And yet that seems to be conveniently ignored now.
Well, I don't know that it has any relevance. I mean, I don't see how that would come up in conversation in this context.
The reason I say that is because she did not know anything about Oswin when the doctor introduced himself at the door. when he says, Clara Oswin Oswald, and she says, just Clara. I mean, she had no idea what Oswin was until she coined it while they were having breakfast.
Which did she coin it, or did the doctor tell her about it and she remembered it? Oswin Oswald.
Well, it could have been that. I mean, either way. But it was not part of her identity as far as she was consciously aware of. But yet, at some point, we know that she is looking over a headstone that's got her full name. It's got a birth date and a death date. And the whole thing just, it just smacks of just way too many loose threads.
Okay, well, but wait a minute. I'm going to say that I could imagine that if I were at a cemetery, and we don't know how long ago that was for her, it could have been years. Obviously the actress looks the same to us, but young people don't age much for a while. But if I'd gone to a cemetery and I'd run across a grave for somebody named Eugene Bartholomew Glover, I don't know for a fact that I would have really committed that to my memory. I'm not going to forget. However, since we mention it, or since you've brought this up, there is another possibility. What was missing in her book of 101 Places to Go? Did you notice?
No.
Age 23.
No, I didn't notice it, no.
Yep, it went 20, 21, 22, 24. And she'd cross them off. So for some reason, 23, not there. Completely. Did she miss that year? Who knows?
Oh, that.
It couldn't possibly be a production mistake.
No, oh heavens, no. That's not a production mistake. No, that's there for a reason. We just don't know what that reason is yet.
Well, that, and I'm sure the leaf is there for a reason too. It was such a stupid answer, and it was such a prominent question and answer. Think, what's with the leaf? Well, it's not a leaf. It is page one. It's
like, page one.
Okay, so we begin with a leaf.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
I don't know, but mark my words, that leaf has some meaning. This means something. Or it's like ducks in a duck pond.
Oh, God.
Or the exploding TARDIS, which we are never, ever going to find out why that damn thing blew up back in Series 5 or whatever it was. We're never going to find out. They've just forgotten it. Gone. Another red herring. Important plot point thrown aside because, I'm bored with that story now. That's all I've got on Clara. I mean, I liked her. I'm really pleased that seem to be past the whole... much though I like Amy, and I did like Amy. I liked Amy a lot. Not just because she's really hot. But I liked her better when she had Rory with her, even though she was usually ass to him. They made a good pair. It was a nice teaming with the doctor. Of course, it got rid of that idiotic romance angle with the doctor once Rory was in there, because they just basically, it was might a little comedy of mistake here once in a while, but there was no serious possibility of a romance going on there.
So we got
companions back into the sort of Ian and Barbara range if they were young and wore miniskirts. But I was going somewhere important with that. But the whole Series 7 and the first half was so, I don't know. It had a sort of fatality to it. It just felt like it had built up a sort of solemn air was winding down to this destruction.
We knew that only because they kept announcing it. They kept talking about how this was going to be the farewell of Amy and Rory, that it was going to be sad, it was going to be tragic, it was going to break the doctor's heart. I mean, so there was this enormous buildup. So naturally, we developed this sense of fatalism when looking at the first half of Season 7.
It was more than that, though. I mean, there was fatalism in the acting. There was fatalism in the situations.
It was so heavy-handed.
Yeah.
And then telegraphed.
Now we're light again. It's light. It's having fun. We're on adventures. And what I'm concerned about is this whole backstory with Clara is going to just bring on the whole heavy-handed, too much story going on, or too much, not story, but too much mythos being layered onto the episodes.
Which does not serve the overall story to begin with.
Not really, no. Doesn't for me.
In fact, I kind of find, to me that seems almost a little pornographic in a writing sense. And I mean that not in a sexual sort of way, but more like in a very cheap, how can I describe that? Just something just a very cheap way of writing the story, trying to prove how much of a nerd you really are by coming up with a very convoluted resolution. I mean, that's what Russell T. Davies did all the time. And it was annoying. It was almost like him trotting himself out there and patting himself on the back, telling the audience, "See how clever I am."
See, now I always felt Russell T. Davies spent all his time trying to develop. And I will give the man credit for this. He could write people and emotions.
Yes.
And my dislike of the way he ties up stories was just simply, well, I've spent 44 minutes, you know, really dealing with the implications of what's going on and how people feel about it and how they interact, and oh, I've got to solve this in 30 seconds. All right, well, let's just pull this out of my sonic screwdriver pouch and solve this problem.
But and, I'm afraid that that's sort of the direction that Moffat is going.
Well, it certainly is every time he lays on these heavy-handed, arc-heavy things. The individual stories aren't as bad. You know, in other words, I felt like this story, all the pieces were there, and the conclusion, although still a little bit rushed, was, you know, set in motion through the story, unlike a Russell T. Davies, where there's no foreshadowing of the solution whatsoever, because the solution doesn't matter. It's just to get you out of the emotional situation. But when you get into these big arcs, like the arc with the impossible astronaut, or, and I mean, he's even worse. I mean, look at between Day of the Moon and Impossible Astronaut, or whichever way it was. You know, why even bother? We don't even bother to solve the problem at the end of one episode. We just ignore it and go on. So, absolutely. Moffat does, when he gets into this big mess, he just sort of, he punts.
Kind of chokes.
Yeah.
And because we saw that kind of pattern in terms of these big story threads, these big season-long story arcs, because we saw RTD blow it at the end repeatedly, it becomes kind of, you get a knee-jerk reaction whenever we start to see that kind of thing happen again. And I can't help but get very nervous, especially in light of how badly I think the entire River Song story has been handled.
Yes.
And then now we're dealing with another companion who is way the heck out of time in some way or another. We saw the very first time we meet her, we see what appears to be her death, and now we see her again, and we see what appears to be her origins. So it's so hard not to draw parallels and become immediately nervous as to where this is going to go. It could be completely unfounded, but I'm just talking in terms of me. That was the reaction that I had. I just looked at where this big arc could go, and to me, it did not feel like a good place.
Here's what depresses me most about an episode I generally enjoy, but what depresses me the most about Moffat's story arcs, and that is, again, if we go back and look at the Russell T. Davies era, and we look at Russell T. Davies' stories, he lays you in for the whole episode. It's deep. It's, you know, at an individual episode, I'm saying. And then he just, you know, throws away a fluff ending at the end. After a couple of those, you get to realize that that's what you're going to get. And so when he fluff off the finale at the end of the year, basically, you kind of go, well, that's how Russell T. Davies rolls, right? But Stephen Moffat has years of writing experience, and I'll use Coupling as an example, although there are others that we could use. It's a very different type of story. It's a farce. And if you look at any one of those episodes, they are absolutely precisely crafted to lay in to you right at the end that everything comes to place for the biggest laugh payoff that they can. That all the little pieces that you didn't see coming were all laid out and put down, and they all come together. There are no red herrings. Every piece comes together for the perfect storm towards the end of that episode. It never does that in Doctor Who. He always is throwing pieces out that just get ignored or don't go. And so I'm expecting something better from him every time. And I've been disappointed in every story arc so far that Moffat has put together. I enjoy the episodes he writes, but damn it, the story arcs really annoy me because I know he could do better.
The only one that he was able to get away with somewhat was the bit with the Pandorica. But even then, I mean, that was the best one of the bunch. It has its issues. And then subsequent stories with the big arc, how it wraps up at the end of the year. Yeah, they were horribly disappointing. It tells me that that's not something Moffat should engage in. He really should be focusing on just individual standalone episodes. That's where his strength lies.
When
he just simply writes a story, like when RTD was a showrunner, and then Moffat would come in with the occasional just a one-off story. I mean, Blink at the time, I don't know if there was any preconceived notions as to any threads that particular episode might be sewing. When I watched it, I just simply viewed that as a single self-contained story, and I enjoyed it just like that. And I enjoyed it enormously. So I kind of think that maybe this is where Moffat should be really applying his strengths and not in this area of trying to do the big story arc, because I don't think his setup is all that great, and then his payoff is even worse. At least with Russell, his setup was amazing. You know, the problem was that he spent so much time setting it up, as we've both observed from time to time, that he has little time to really deliver the resolution. In the case of Moffat, I just think he doesn't even know how to do the setup correctly and thereby giving us a proper resolution.
What I was going to say is, you said they kind of resolved Pandorica, but let's face it, why did the TARDIS blow up? We just mentioned that one earlier. That's still completely... They've never given an answer to that, and they never will.
Not a real good one. It's something that Rivers doing inside the TARDIS that caused it.
Whose voice pops up in the TARDIS console and says, "The silence will fall."
I know, we never get that. I know, yes. Yeah, so there are clearly unanswered questions. I mean, I'm not saying that it was perfect. Not by any means. It has problems. Huge problems. But it was the most rewarding out of all of them so far. And it's just been going downhill ever since.
Yeah. I don't want to be too down on it. I'm still enjoying the show. It's just that particularly the so-called payoff episodes for the story arcs let me down, because not only are they letting me down as a story, because they're not complete stories. They're just kind of like the last chapter in what was turned out to be what was supposed to be a book, except that the book is an anthology of different stories, and the last one isn't a full story. It's just sort of a mess to kind of...
It feels like the appendix.
Let's see. References to the past 50th anniversary season, I suppose we're going to expect to see some various little bits here and there. I mean, the book, not the 101 Places to See, but the other book
book that was written by Amelia
Williams, yes. I wonder who that could be.
Yeah, and of course that whole bit where Clara says, "Chapter 11, you'll cry your eyes out."
Yeah,
And, of course, Matt Smith being the 11th Doctor.
Right. We have the woman down at the shop. We don't know what that is. Could be Sally Sparrow from Blink. So they can mess that story up, too.
Oh, God, I hope not.
Although, how would she have his phone number? So I don't think that's actually...
There's no way she would have that.
Yeah, it almost has to be River.
It's got to be River, because who else would have it?
Unit? The boys from Unit show up?
Yeah, but it was so almost superfluous.
So did they show up because the Doctor called them? Or did they show up because they've been monitoring the Great Intelligence?
Good question.
Yeah, no answer on that one.
Answer.
But, obviously, the history with the Great Intelligence, though, is there because the Great Intelligence, when...
Knew the Doctor.
Well, not just knew the Doctor, knew Unit.
Yeah.
Ms. Kislet said the people from Unit, they seem to be friends of the Doctor. And they go, oh, yes, very old friends.
Well, and it would sort of I mean, it'd be nice to get a sense of the history of the Great Intelligence. I get the idea that it's far more linear in terms of its historical context as opposed to the Doctor, who's forever jumping around in time, that, of course, the Great Intelligence in the 21st century clearly remembers everything that happened in Web of Fear.
And so what happened in the Abominable Snowman? The Abominable Snowman would have been after the Snowman, but before Web of Fear in our timeline.
Yeah.
So why did they go with this Yeti route and then not? Well, I don't know.
That's the problem. I think. I mean, a lot of people I know that when I saw the episode with the Great Intelligence and at Christmas, I thought, "Oh, that's mighty clever." But now you got to shoehorn this thing into some sort of established canon. Keep in mind, however, you know that we're trying to apply this idea of continuity that seems to be more prevalent today than it was back in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So, rectify these two, they're almost disparate kind of continuities going on here. It's almost a pointless task.
All right, let's pick on the plot. My main concern, I watched it, like I said, I watched it, I enjoyed it, it kind of led me from point A to point B, but when you watch it again, you notice your shoelaces are untied. And therein lies the problem. I mean, for example, the Great Intelligence, we've been kind of given its origin, correct? The Snowman. It's really a reflection of Richard E. Grant's, as a child's, sort of, whatever, his mental illness problem. I didn't get anything that we could prove. Well, I mean, it must have come in from space somehow, but the Turian... I'm really disappointed that it's not Ian McKellen the voice, but...
I know. I think that...
Richard E. Grant's obviously cheaper.
That's exactly right.
But so the Great Intelligence has been on Earth since 1870s, 1880s, whenever the Snowman was, and it's been plowing along, trying to take over the planet. And it comes up with this brilliant idea. Now, first off, we don't really know what it needs the mines for. But, okay. The implication is it eats them, but they don't seem to be going away. They seem to be just perpetually...
That's kind of puzzling, too. I wondered about that. Because at first, we get this sense that the intelligence, or the client, takes care of them. And it's almost like this sense of immortality through it.
Nobody loves hamburger cows more than Burger King.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, apparently, it's going to eat them anyway, so...
But it has developed these spoonheads, or servers, as we like to call them. And they go out, and they set up Wi-Fi access points with funky alien characters that... Don't click on that. Don't blink on those. Click on those. Yeah. Why? Why alien characters? What makes you think your computer would even be able to display those alien characters? I mean, if you go into the Windows pop-up and for wireless, click on the wireless button, you're going to get a list in your base language.
Exactly.
Or any font that's installed on your computer, but it is not going to have those alien signals. And what stupid intelligence would use something like that as bait to trick people into clicking on it? Why wouldn't it pick things like, oh, I don't know, free Wi-Fi?
Well, you'd obviously want to use something that seems harmless.
And why would you use a technique that seems to be, I mean, okay, let's say that you're a seasoned computer professional or you're, you know, well up. Do you click on random Wi-Fi access points? No, you do not.
No.
No, you do not. So Clara's intelligent, but borderline, because she doesn't have computer skills. They decide to go with her anyway and give her the computer skills. Does that mean the other people had the computer skills to begin with? And so they were tricking clever people too stupid enough not to click on the alien Wi-Fi spot. That kind of works against it. And then why bother collect intelligent people when you could just splice whatever intelligence you want into them on the way up anyhow?
Exactly. It felt kind of like a big paradox.
And why would you have to trick people into clicking on the Wi-Fi access point if, as is demonstrated throughout the entire rest of the episode, you can make anyone do anything you want to anyway?
Yeah, because they're exposed.
They've been exposed to the Wi-Fi.
Anyway.
So they've got control of everyone for limited times. They could just pick people out, have them go, oh, go to your computer, click on the link. Okay. And then they're in. So, again, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, how did the spoonhead get into her house? Do they teleport there? Her house is locked up. The doctor's locked out. How did it get in the house?
Good question. No answer.
No answer. And no point. Again, it just doesn't make any sense. The story does fall apart rapidly when you start thinking about what they've done.
And why use the image of the girl from the cover of that book? Why not go ahead and use
a member of her family? Somebody from her mind, yeah.
Well, just like when they finally do get her later on in the episode, they use an image of the doctor. Why use that girl on that cover? It made no sense to do that.
It should have been the girl who lives in the house.
Absolutely.
Or the father, or, you know, one
somebody
of the boys.
That somebody she knows personally who's in that house.
Yeah, I'd be freaked out if, like, the cover of one of my Simon Templar books walked into the room. Because, like, I'd recognize it, and I'd be like, that's just creepy. That's my main jut thing. And, no. I forgot one. The airplane. So let's consider this a very clever scheme. They activate the people all around the doctor and Clara. They have them turn on the lights. They activate all of London, it appears, and they have them turn off the lights. This makes a big, bright, glowing target for them to hit. The question is, who's going to hit it? Because the pilot and co-pilot have been put to sleep. So it's not like they're steering the plane at the big, bright patch. They're asleep.
Yeah.
Who is steering the plane at the big bright patch?
Not until the doctor gets on board.
Uh-huh. A clever idea, a clever scene, but, like, doesn't hold up to any scrutiny at all. And that's what's diminishing my enjoyment of this story on subsequent viewing. You know, it's funny. There are some other Doctor Who podcasts. Well, not that we are a Doctor Who podcast, but there are other podcasts that talk about Doctor Who. And they have likened modern Doctor Who to viewing habits have changed. Things like Netflix and DVD box sets and whatnot have changed the way people consume television programs. Lots of people do not even watch a series until it's done anymore. And then they strip it. They watch, you know, one or two episodes a night on their thing.
They can mainline it.
They can mainline it. And so you can actually tell a story that, you know, mainlining Babylon 5 would make it so much better than it was spewed out over 5 years.
Oh,
because
God,
it really was.
Lost is the only way to watch it.
And so Doctor Who has been made to mainline. It's been main, like many shows, with that mentality in mind, and you can expect people to watch it more than once because it's on demand. They'll have the box set, and so you could, in theory, layer stuff into the show that you don't get until multiple viewings. So you go, oh, see, I didn't catch it the first time through, but then having seen the end of the episode, when I watch it again, the first part now makes sense. It was like a blow off line, but now suddenly I'm like, ah. Oh, I see where you were going with that. Very clever, Mr. Moffat. But I don't get that from these episodes. I watch them again, and they fall apart.
And the more you watch it, the more they fall apart.
The more they fall apart. I mean, yeah. At some point, I assume there'll be a law of diminishing returns on falling apartedness, and I will have caught all of the falling apart bits. But
and at that point, you will cease to like the episode. You will then kind of almost hate it.
So, I don't. Like I said, how could you hate this episode? Even the Doctor in his zany mode is not so zany as to irritate me. It's really a almost picture perfect 11th Doctor performance, and Clara is just adorable. You just want to pinch her cheeks, right? I mean,
if you say so.
Yeah. Well. So that's my thought on the episode. I liked the way the Doctor resolved the problem.
It's funny you mentioned that. There was a scene in this episode that, on the surface, it kind of bugged me because it sort of harkened back to something that we might have seen David Tennant's Doctor do, and that was the bit with the anti-grav motorcycle riding up the side of a building, and I thought, okay, all right, he's clever, but that really is a bit much. And I was willing to go along with it, but one pleasant surprise was finding out that he really didn't do it, that he simply used the computer to hack into them. I thought that was clever, and that the whole thing was just simply a figment of their imagination.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. I was of the impression that they did in fact see that he did in fact drive up the side of the building. Not him, of course. It was the Spoonhead in his disguise. Spoiler. And
that's true.
After the summary, I mean, there's no spoilers. This is not a spoiler-free zone. I still was of the impression that he in fact did do that.
Well, you're right. It was the Spoonhead that did go up there.
Okay.
But I love the fact that it was the Doctor who was just pulling all the strings.
But it could actually have been an illusion, because the only way they observed it was through their own technology. And so if he had hacked it, then, he actually might have been able to simulate it. Although how he got the motorcycle into the office is another story. But, yeah, I assume it's... And I accept the motorcycle... For one reason. I accept the anti-grav motorcycle because it came out of the TARDIS.
True.
It is not a motorcycle that he whipped out the sonic screwdriver and attached some thing he had in his pocket. It was like, oh, the Beryllian anti-gravity drive I picked up on Cygnus Alpha 4. And then it's now an anti-grav. But he didn't do that. He went into the TARDIS garage, where I fully believe that he could have the motorcycle he picked up 100 years in the future, yeah, or whatever, that can do anti-grav. But you have to get it out of the TARDIS, and you have to show that you're getting it out of the TARDIS. So, for me to take that one. But, again, he was clever. He outsmarted them. That's what I like to see the Doctor do to win a game. And that's where I'm willing to accept a missing piece of the story, because if you look at it, the Doctor sees the Spoonhead in the cafe, and he pulls out the sonic screwdriver, and that's the last we see from the Spoonhead's point of view, right? I mean, you cut to the next scene. So you could rightly go, well, actually, I don't know what happened to the Spoonhead, but you're just guessing that he destroyed it or deactivated it. And so there was a piece of redirection and a piece that they didn't show explicitly what happened that, works, because the payoff comes later. What doesn't work is that Spoonhead was absolutely dead on perfect, behaving exactly like the Doctor, until his head spun around.
Yeah.
And then when it spun back and he was manipulating the iPad at the end that could hack all the people, Then it was acting like a robot, making all robot-y noises and stuff, and moving in a jerky, robotic way. So why isn't it back to smooth now that its head's turned around? Don't insult me. Just go back to the way it was.
I'm liking this episode less and less now.
Fusion Patrol, where we talk you out of believing an episode was good. That should be our motto.
I think so.
Everyone in the world loved Man from Atlantis until we started talking about it.
Oh, God.
So we got anything else in this episode?
Not really, no.
So next time, the Keys of Marinus. No.
Oh, yeah.
It's the Keys of Akhenaten? It's something of Akhenaten. The rings.
The rings of Akhenaten or something like that.
Hackisack. The rings of Hackisack. Or however they pronounce it.
Rings of Hasikasi.
Throat Wobbler Mangrove. That's how it's spelled luxury yacht, but it's pronounced Throat Wobbler Mangrove. And we'll be back for that episode. Same bat time, same bat channel.
God.
Thank you for joining me, Ben.
My pleasure.
We'll talk to you all again next time on another episode of Fusion Patrol.
End of line.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Username, Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.